Part 2 of 6 from set number 3001, Alchemy Past and Present. A BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Transforming the Self, Jung, Psychology and Alchemy.
This is the second in our series on alchemy. It may be useful for us to recollect that alchemy is the ancient, indeed perhaps one might say timeless, art of transformation, that it is of a historically and geographically ubiquitous character. We can find it in many different places, and there are idiosyncratic differences depending on where we find it, such as, for instance, we mentioned Chinese alchemy as being rather different from Western alchemy, but alchemy it is nevertheless. Our word alchemy comes to us from the Arabs, who had contacted apparently the alchemical art of transformation in Egypt after they conquered it, and referred to it as the Egyptian art or the Egyptian thing, al-chem, from whence alchemy is derived. It is perhaps useful also to recollect again that one of the chief characteristics of alchemy, which is of extremely great importance for its understanding, is the principle of transformation, which is essentially different from other forms of change that are envisioned of various kinds, and particularly very different from unidirectional growth, because it implies a substantial altering of the fundamental nature of things before transformation can take place. So while when we are dealing with growth as a linear extension, this kind of radical change is not necessary. But in alchemy it is. And we mentioned, for instance, which is always a good one to recollect again, one of the best metaphors or metaphoric examples that we can find among living creatures found in the insect kingdom, wherein various insects go into a larval stage where they spin themselves into a cocoon, and then inside the cocoon the creature undergoes a complete transformation. And that transformation is not merely a modification of the shape of its body, but rather the body becomes reduced to an inchoate mass of a biological nature, and this mass then reorganizes, reconstellates itself in a completely new manner, so that the silkworm or other kind of worm that has spun itself into a cocoon comes out as a butterfly, certainly of a very different character than he has had before. Now, taking that as our metaphor, what we need to remember then, in alchemical change, there is first a complete breaking down of the existing situation, of the existing structure, a disorganization, a reduction of the present organization of substances to a condition of chaos. There is something nowadays that is sort of being voiced about, and that some of you are probably aware of, that is called chaos theory. Whether that this has much potential meaning for alchemy or not remains to be determined. But there are a reasonably large number of scientists at the present time, certainly not all, but a good many, who have come to the conclusion that the underlying principle of the universe and of physical structures, physical systems of one kind or the other, is not so much that of an orderly system as has been assumed for a long time, particularly since Isaac Newton, but that really underneath the appearance of the orderly system there is quite the opposite of that, namely a lack of order, a chaos. And the reason for that that being that the outcome, the future, so the scientists say, of any kind of system, including the cosmos, you know, that's cosmos is just a Greek word for system. Be a nice idea to kind of play with that a little bit, because a lot of people are very enamored of anything cosmic. You know, everything is coming up cosmic. And so if you just change that and say for it system or systematic, then it sounds far less sort of mysterious and exciting and wonderful, because most people don't like systems. But a lot of people like being cosmic. Unfortunately, the two things are the same. In any event, what the scientists say, and this involves physics primarily, in theoretical physics, what many of the scientists are saying is that the only way to predict what is going to happen with a system would be to have a complete knowledge of all the factors, all the circumstances involved in its beginnings. And since such knowledge is not available to us, actually, therefore, everything in the physical world is unpredictable. We can't really predict with any degree of accuracy. A good example is the weather. We have a lot of weathermen, and I dare say weather women also, usually wearing beautiful suits, which I generally admire on television. You notice how the weathermen are always so much better dressed than the newsmen. Now, there must be a reason for this. I haven't quite figured it out, but when I figure it out, I promise you, I will tell you, if you are here so I can tell you. I don't know how long it's going to take me. In any event, it is sort of axiomatic that the prediction of the weather is a very uncertain art or science. In fact, I heard the story of a weatherman in some town who was working there, who submitted his resignation, and in his written resignation he said that I resign my position because in this part of the country the climate doesn't agree with me, the weather doesn't agree with me. Well, in any event, the reason I brought this up, I almost forgot, was the issue of chaos. Now, the contention of alchemy isn't so much that the existing system, whatever that system may be, because as we shall soon see, alchemy can be applied to many different things, that the existing system is chaos, but rather that in order for something radically new to emerge from the existing conditions, the existing conditions themselves have to be altered so that they are reduced to a creative chaos. And out of that creative chaos, then, in accordance with a rather specific process of transformation, eventually something completely new, something radically new will emerge. Ostensibly, when we look at alchemical books, ostensibly, we find that alchemy seems to address itself to physical matter, to chemicals, in effect. And that the alchemical process would take place by way of various physical substances, chemical substances being placed into a vessel, and then they're combined in a particular prescribed manner while a steady, unvarying heat is applied to them in the alchemical furnace, the slow, steady flame of the alchemist. We know, of course, that once again the ostensible result, the ultimate result of the alchemical process was held up as being the philosopher's stone, or the stone of the philosophers, lapis philosophorum. Also accompanied by some other substances such as the elixir of life, as it is called, and others. These ultimate results of the alchemical process were envisioned as being quite supernatural and miraculous in character. So out of the combining and recombining of the natural, something more than natural, something above the natural, supernatural, comes to be. And this supernatural result, often referred to as the stone of the philosophers, then is capable of producing all kinds of very, very astonishing, miraculous, magical results. Among these being that if someone is in possession of the philosopher's stone, the philosopher's stone can then be applied to, base, as they were called, base metals, such as lead, iron, brass, but particularly lead, and would change that base metal into gold, into something precious. So we need to keep in mind that the alchemical process itself, the process of transformation itself, was not the one designed to produce gold. It is somewhat mistaken to say that the alchemists wanted to make gold. The alchemists wanted to produce the philosopher's stone, and the philosopher's stone then would have the capacity to miraculously change various substances into gold. All right? I don't want to spend the whole evening recapitulating, but this is an important issue. Now, keeping all of this in mind, we need to ask the question, was alchemy, at least let's say Western alchemy, always engaged in the attempted transformation of physical substances? Was this always a physical art? Or science, they called it the art, because ars, art, in Latin, means something other than what we often now call art. It is really the fine skill of doing something important. That is what the ancients called art. And also, an art is always something that is done. A science, scientia, is something that is known. Science is knowledge, etymologically and historically. So if you would go back, into the 16th century and something like that, if you would find somebody who says, I am a scientist, I am concerned with science, this would be a person who is interested in knowledge, learning something in his mind. But an alchemist and even a ceremonial magician, I spoke about that not very long time ago, would be called a practitioner of an art, because what he or she would be doing would be just that. It would be doing something rather than learning something. All right, now, there is some doubt concerning the generally accepted notion that alchemy, at least Western alchemy, was always a physical activity, an activity involving physical elements. Why? Because it is known that particularly in the that very creative period of history that reaches from maybe about 300 or so B.C., until 300 or 400 AD in the Mediterranean area, particularly Egypt, which first Hellenized Egypt after the conquest by Alexander the Great, so a mingling of ancient Egyptian and Greek elements, and then subsequently after the conquest by the Roman Empire with the Roman elements as well. So that we know that within that period, let's say the model, the paradigm of transformation was employed to a major extent in a context that was not primarily chemical or physical, but rather it was human. In other words, there were people there, Neoplatonists, Gnostics, Hermeticists, Neopythagoreans, and probably a whole number of others, maybe some minor schools of whom even the names have been forgotten, who were all practicing transformation, but not transformation of physical elements in a vessel as much as the transformation of mind, transformation of soul, transformation of what modern depth psychology calls psyche, which is again just a Greek word for soul, but to which we have attached a certain modern connotations. These people all believed that human nature, primarily the interior nature of the human being, can change. And not just a little bit, and not just again by way of extension, but substantially, very, very powerfully, tremendously. So that the ultimate outcome of the change of human nature would produce something, well, superhuman. Just like in physical alchemy, chemical alchemy, and incidentally the word chemistry is also derived from alchemy, modern chemistry started out as a kind of byproduct of alchemy. And an awful lot of things within modern chemistry and even in other areas of life were really developed originally by the alchemists, because the alchemists did a lot of things. For instance, distillation is an alchemical process and something that was developed, invented and developed and popularized by the alchemists. So if it weren't for the alchemists, the chances are that for quite a long time we wouldn't have had, for instance, any distilled alcohol. We would only have fermented alcohol. Of course, the alchemists were also interested in fermentation, because that is another one of the sort of physical metaphors for transformation also. And I don't know whether you ever played around with some things. I mentioned last time that when I was a little boy, I used to play around with mercury by breaking as many thermometers in the household as I possibly could, to the great dismay of my parents. Why are these thermometers always breaking? Well, they're breaking because I broke them. the mercury was a lot of fun to play with. I never got poisoned. I was smart enough not to put it in my mouth. A good Hungarian boy has better things to put in his mouth than mercury. I have also certainly observed and even tried in a very, very sort of primitive way to make wine. So if you wonder who the little old winemaker is, you can get some ideas now. But you know, just by crushing grapes and putting them into some little vessel, just a big glass or something, and just waiting and letting it happen. And it's really a lot of fun to watch that sort of thing. Especially when you're aware of alchemical principles, you can see the alchemy working there. So you have grape juice, okay? When you squeeze out the grape, you have grape juice. And grape juice is generally a fairly clear, nice looking and nicely tasting substance. You all have drunk grape juice. But when you have the natural, unpasteurized grape juice, maybe with some of the other portions of the grape in it too. After a while, the fermentation begins. And what happens? The grape juice changes into something that doesn't look and doesn't taste and doesn't smell like the original grape juice at all. It becomes dirty looking, it becomes cloudy. It brings up a foam with all kinds of impurities in it. Undergoes a real nigredo, a real dark phase. It looks much, much worse initially than it looked or tasted or smelled to begin with. Well, I don't want to go on with the analogy forever, but there is the alchemy of fermentation, where if you let the fermentation process go on to its end, you get wine. And I'm sure it's no news to you that a wine has certain effects, very, very different from mere grape juice. Right? Now, when that transformation process is yet even more intensified, when it undergoes the volatilization, a very alchemical process, we spoke about that a little bit last time, that what happens is that by heating it up in a certain way, alchemically, the liquid now changes into a vapor. It rises up to the sky. It rises up. This is the soul of the philosopher's stone that is trying to form. It is the sublimatio, as it is called in alchemy. So it rises up, and then when it's led through a certain convoluted pipes and so forth, where it cools again, comes back down and turns back into liquid again. But what happened in the process has been distillation, that when the, when you are distilling wine, by the time it goes through all of this, it has become brandy, which is yet very much stronger than what happened before. So you see, something has come about that is very, very, very different from what was there before. That's what all of these things really mean. But it has to go through certain processes of doing that. So many, many of these things were really developed by the alchemists, not because they wanted to open up a lot of saloons where they would sell distilled liquors or things of that sort, but because all of these demonstrated the principle of this radical change, radical transformation. Now, jumping back to what we said before, it was recognized throughout the ages that the human being can undergo a radical transformation, and that at the end of that transformation, the outcome of that transformation will be that the human consciousness, as we call it now, will be as different from the original human consciousness as, let us say, brandy is different from wine, or wine is different from grape juice. The mysteries of the ancients, the Eleusinian mysteries, for instance, and many others, were designed to bring about, to facilitate that kind of transformation. In the Alexandrian period, the mysteries were not the only ones any longer doing this, but the setting of human transformation changed, and we had schools of thought, like I mentioned before, Neoplatonists and Gnostics and other curious folk who were doing this. Or I don't get bored because, you know, people around here get easily bored with history, I think primarily because they had such abominable teachers in school. If you had some good history teachers like I had, at least a couple of them, then you would have a different attitude. But in any event, what happened was that a certain difficulty came upon the scene, and the difficulty was called Christianity. And Christianity took over, and it was by then, it wasn't a very tolerant and a very intelligent kind of Christianity, but rather one that was very jealous of its prerogatives and that pushed every other school of thought out of the way. So persecutions of the earlier transformationally oriented schools and mysteries took place. Now, it is not established with any degree of absolute certainty, but it is considered by many people very likely that at that point some of the people who were previously engaged in human transformation, in transforming from within human beings, have hit on the idea of either going back to, or maybe it wasn't such a thing as going back to, but of developing or further developing physical alchemy. And spiritual transformation now was changed into physical transformation. Why? Because the spiritual transformation was subject to persecution. The physical transformation was not. Not only that, but pretty soon the alchemists even managed to convince, which is probably something I mentioned before, various powerful people, kings and princes and popes and what have yous, especially probably a lot of what have yous, and that if given enough of an opportunity, they would produce the Philosopher's Stone, and then the sky would be a limit of what one could do. For one thing, then one really would produce gold. One would heal people who are sick. And if one was very, very lucky, one could even prolong one's life just about indefinitely, because the statement is definitely there in the alchemical books that the Philosopher's Stone would bestow immortality. Of course, we spoke about that somewhat in connection with Chinese alchemy, that indeed might be more of a metaphor for a timeless consciousness rather than physical immortality, but still there it was. So physical alchemy was never persecuted. Physical alchemy was considered a potentially very useful activity. In fact, powerful and rich people would subsidize the alchemists. They would give them what nowadays would be called government grants. And I'm sure that you didn't have to engage for weeks and weeks in writing an application for a grant, but you just had to butter up the local prince sufficiently and convince him that if he supported you long enough, you could probably produce some gold, and you were set up as an alchemist for many years. However, once again, the theory, the contention is that at least on the part of a substantial number of alchemists, this was a deliberate ploy. That there were still a lot of alchemists who, even though they were practicing physical alchemy in the manner in which I outlined in our first talk, what they were really after, what they were really practicing under the appearance of physical alchemy was spiritual transformation. Or as a learned gentleman from Holland, Professor Hilles Quispel, a very dear gentleman who now should be in his 80s, but this was maybe a dozen years ago, I think he was just getting around 70, said to us here in the auditorium when we had him here, Professor Quispel said, "Alchemy was the yoga of the Gnostics." Because he's a Gnostic scholar, a scholar of Gnosticism. However, what I am now outlining to you, including Professor Quispel's statement, was really brought into focus by someone in the latter part of our own 20th century, and that was none other than the Swiss psychologist, and I think we might call him psychologist and philosopher in the old sense, Carl Gustav Jung. You know, I wrote books about Jung and did all kinds of things, so I could go on and on and on about old Carl, but I won't do that now. But let me just say that Jung was, of course, from the time that Well, from the time that he was very young. So let's say when Jung, from the time on that Jung was young, and from that you could go on forever Jung and all of that. But he was, of course, primarily interested all his life in human transformation. That's why he became a psychologist. He was the son of a minister, but he never really sympathized too much with the religious approach of his father's church. He always suspected that there was something a little more direct, a little more personal, a little more experiential, really, in the back of true religion than what he saw in his father's church, mere formalism and intellectualism. And so quite early in his years, he became interested in these early schools of transformation, Gnostics and Hermeticists and people of this sort. And he studied very assiduously everything that he could find about these folk. Then, sort of when he came around, he was born in 1875, so by the time he was about in his 30s, in his 40s, he came to a sort of an impasse. By then, of course, he had become a psychologist, he had become an associate of the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, you know, and all of that. But Jung came to a sort of an impasse because he had studied all the available literature on these ancient schools of transformation. And he sort of learned everything that was there. And one of the things that he puzzled about greatly was, what happened? What became of the active practice of internal transformation after the 3rd or the 4th century? So what happened? And that is when he hit on the idea, stimulated by some dreams and so forth, but then also, let's say, stimulated by a great deal of scholarship, that what happened was that at least a certain amount, a certain approach of a transformational nature had changed into alchemy. In fact, here is a little quotation from Jung himself. This is fairly early, around 1912 or so, he wrote, "First, I had to find evidence for the historical prefiguration of my inner experience of transformation. That is to say, I had to ask myself, where have my particular premises occurred in history? If I had not succeeded in finding such evidence, I would never have been able to substantiate my ideas. Therefore, my encounter with alchemy was decisive for me, as it provided me with the historical basis which I hitherto lacked." So what really happened was that Jung himself had undergone experiences of very dramatic interior transformation. He was a man of remarkable internal experiences, and this was really the motivation and the stimulus of his psychology. Not everybody knows that, but such was the case. And he looked for corroborative evidence of his experiences in other earlier disciplines. He found a certain amount of it among the Gnostics and the Hermeticists, but then he came to that stop. Now, there is something a little bit of importance here which I think I should mention, and that is that Jung's attitude and method in this regard is very commendable. And one wishes that more people, say, at the present time, would have a similar attitude. Because we are what Jung himself has called, actually, a deracinated people, a deracinated culture. That means we are rootless. We don't have any roots. We don't, which really means we don't consider our roots. You remember that fellow, whoever he was, that African-American gentleman some years ago, Haley, who of course was looking for his roots and then traced his ancestry back to Africa and so forth. Now, that is roots in times of genealogy and culture. Just as there are roots in times of genealogy and culture, there are also roots of spiritual experiences, which are of course very important, at least to some of us. Now, no experience of the human being occurs in a vacuum. There is always a context. Things are always coming from somewhere. Things that are not coming from anywhere are in all likelihood not going anywhere either. to a certain extent, and one shouldn't go overboard on any of these things, extremism is always, extreme. extremism becomes counterproductive. But up to a certain extent, it is very important to find a context for our experiences. That is when our experience becomes useful. That is when it becomes assimilable. You know, it's not that difficult to have unusual experiences. If I can swear some of you to secrecy and, you know, you come on outside behind the building, I'll tell you a whole bunch of ways in which you can have unusual experiences. In addition to going to the neighborhood bar and belting down a few, which after all is also an alchemical activity. Don't sell it that short either, you know. The only trouble with alcohol as a consciousness-altering substance is that it is much too short-acting. Because it's based on sugar, really. I'm talking now as an alchemist. And therefore it has to be constantly replenished. And that's what makes a person into an alcoholic. And also makes you eventually feel terrible and get horrible hangovers and all that sort of thing. And ruins your liver. So it's not a very good consciousness-altering substance for that very reason. But, you know, there are all kinds of ways in which a person can have unusual experiences. And in fact, some of them are legal. Believe it or not. Even in our blasted culture, some of them are still legal, but many of them are not. However, the problem is not so much how to have an unusual experience, but the problem is far more how to have an unusual experience and profit from the unusual experience, to really be able to turn it into something that is useful to your consciousness in the long run, that can contribute really meaningfully to the changing of your nature into something greater and better, into the expansion of your consciousness. Altering consciousness is one thing, and I'm all in favor of it. But altering consciousness is only one step. Real expansion of consciousness must follow suit. Otherwise, just the altering itself is of relatively minor import. And so what the way Jung and people of this inclination would have expressed it would be that there needs to be an assimilation of experience. Before the assimilation, there is also such a thing as amplification of the experience, because one of the problems, there is not really so much. Take it from me. There is not so much qualitative difference between experiences that can be had in a very sober state and, let's say, several micrograms of LSD. There is not that much difference between them, really. The problem is that the altered experiences of a less intense nature, which are not chemically amplified to such an extent, let's say, are easily missed. They are not readily recognized. The miracle is around us all the time. And the miracle is always miraculous. But we don't see it. Why don't we see it? Because there is no drama there. There are so many other things going on. And so the other circumstances of perception and of life arrest our attention, And the heightened sense of consciousness is lost. Therefore, when the heightened sense of consciousness is amplified, then awareness, memory, comes. The ancients, the Gnostics, my old friends, the Neoplatonists and others have always said that transformation is a matter of remembering. That somehow there is a gnosis, an awareness, a heightened perception that we had before, but we don't remember it. We are suffering from amnesia, and which means non-remembering. And that therefore the amnesia has to be undone by what in Greek is called an anamnesis, remembering. And that remembering is heightening of consciousness. Or it may also be called, in at least when it occurs according to a certain pattern and a certain process, alchemy. But there needs to be a context. That's what I started all this out with. And the context is a method of remembering. The context hastens remembrance. And the context amplifies the experience. That is why an unusual experience of consciousness, a non-ordinary state of consciousness that occurs outside of a meaningful context, is usually lost. Alchemy is such a context, and there are, of course, others. Jung then recollected later, writing about his experiences along these lines, alchemy represented the historical link with the ancient arts of transformation. I am inserting that he said with Gnosticism. And continuity therefore existed between past and present. Grounded in the natural philosophy of the Middle Ages, alchemy formed the bridge on the one hand into the past, to Gnosticism, and on the other into the future, to the modern psychology of the unconscious. So I think we need to keep in mind that there has to be a continuity between the past and the present. And that continuity between the past and the present allows us to remember. So that this doesn't mean that we have to have a morbid fascination with the past. I think that Freudian psychology, for instance, often has a morbid fascination with certain aspects of the past. An unholy interest in the mysteries of toilet training. And all kind of postulated fantasies of childhood, Oedipus complex, Electra complex, and all of these things. That's a false past. But there is a different one. That is where Freud misunderstood the situation, because he had no real concept of a spiritual past, of a condition of consciousness, a purity of perception that we experienced somewhere, somehow, not necessarily in chronological history, but out of time and out of space, literally, as the storytellers put it, once upon a time, which we then need to remember. Now then, this is how the great modern alchemist C.G. Jung came to his vital interest in alchemy. And it's really this one man who, with his considerable influence throughout, certainly, much of the 20th century, came to rehabilitate alchemy and allowed much of the interest, the consciousness of at least certain elements in our contemporary culture to come to focus upon it again. Now, having sort of drawn that line, now as time passes, we need to focus ultimately on what was it really that at a more practical level that Jung saw in alchemy. He saw in alchemy a pattern of the transformation of the human soul, of the human psyche. He said the human psyche has the capacity to transform, and it does that transforming, so to say, very much according to a pattern that is very, very similar to, indeed almost identical with, the pattern of alchemy. If you are familiar with the transformation of the human consciousness, if you are working with people, for instance, as he did in psychotherapy, trying to assist them in the transformation of their own consciousness, because that is really what Jungian analysis and Jungian therapy was always about, you encounter automatically, you encounter a pattern of transformation that is extremely similar to alchemy. In fact, he found that it is much, let's say, the parallel between the various phases and sub-phases of the alchemical transformation as the alchemists describe it in their literature, on the one hand, and the transformation of the human psyche on the other, is much closer, much more directly applicable than a lot of other models. Now, there are transformational models in many different things, especially in religious mysticism, in various branches of the esoteric tradition, let's say in the mythos of the Rosicrucians and of Kabbalah and all kinds of places. But Jung found that the alchemical one is so striking and so practical that he ended up concentrating on it to a major extent and wrote at least 3 great big major books on alchemy from a psychological point of view, the most important of which is, they're all in C.G. Jung's collected writings, Psychology and Alchemy, Alchemical Studies, and the Latin title Mysterium Conjunctionis. But alchemical thinking runs through a lot of his other writings, and the one that I would recommend, because the others are really rather formidable and big, you know. But the one that I would recommend is in the volume of his collected writings called The Practice of Psychotherapy. Let me see if I can find it in here. And there is an essay there by Jung on the subject of, and sounds like a very psychological subject, called The Psychology of the Transference. Look for that, The Psychology of the Transference. It has also been issued as a separate volume and these reprints, you know. And The Psychology of the Transference concerns primarily the 10 pictures, the 10 images to which I alluded last time, of the Rosarium Philosophorum, an old alchemical codex that has 10 pictures, actually 11 because there is an alternative for one, and that shows sort of 10 stages of the alchemical transformation. Now then, let me just, that's about all I can do, I think, at this point, is to sort of indicate to you how this alchemical analogy works. First of all, we don't have the time to go into a lot of Jungian psychological theory here, but let's just say that Jung was different from most of the other psychologists in as much as he recognized that there is an inbuilt tendency, an inbuilt drive in the human psyche toward transformation. You know, Freud said that we are motivated by the pleasure principle. We all want to feel good and we don't want to feel bad. Well, I think we can agree with that. And unless you're a masochist, then you don't particularly like feeling bad. And unless you're a fool, you don't mind feeling good. So there's nothing wrong with that. But it doesn't go deep enough. What our psyche is really trying to do is to transform into something greater. What do we mean by greater? What we mean is having more consciousness, having a greater conscious awareness of reality at all of its different levels. to extend the magic circle of the magic lighted circle of our consciousness. That is what we are really trying to do. From the time that we are little, the psyche is trying to do that. And at different phases of life, it engages in various stratagems in doing that. But, once again, like with the silkworm and or the caterpillar and the butterfly, the pattern of the transformation of the human psyche is not one of linear growth. And thereby hangs the tale, as Shakespeare put it in As You Like It. You know, Shakespeare was quite fond of puns. So you got to keep that in mind. It's a good form of humor, even though people think it isn't. But the tale that hangs by this is that consciously, in our egos, we really don't very much like that kind of transformation. We would much rather have a linear extension of our already available consciousness, which would mean primarily of our ego. What most people really mean when they talk about intellectual or even spiritual growth is that they want to have more of what they already have. Or they want to be more of what they already are. Now, if I wanted to be very uncharitable, which occasionally I am, I would say, of course, that would mean that when a fool grows spiritually, he would just become a bigger fool. And I think that does occur quite often. This is the kind of change where there is no change in kind, only in volume, an extension in volume, right? But what is really happening in the human psyche when things are going the way they ought to is much more alchemical, said Jung. So what this means is, for instance, that periodically in most of our lives, if we are really, you know, on the path of transformation, shall we say, we come to places where we kind of have to undergo a dark phase. Consciousness sometimes has to darken before it is really enlightened. Well, I'm inspired by that old picture of the Buddha back on the wall that I look at when I'm sitting here. You know, very nice picture. I wish they would give it to me. That'll be the day. But what happened to Buddha before he was enlightened? He reached the end of his rope. That's what happened. He did all kinds of exercises and yoga and fasting and all that sort of thing, probably standing on his head for endless periods. And then he said, in so many words, to hell with it. You know, none of this is doing anything. I'm not really getting anywhere. And he got to the point where he was only eating one kernel of rice a day or something of that, which is, I'm sure, very economical. And he said, this is not working. He sat down and ate a good meal. I don't know what it consisted of. His disciples, who were, I think, all habitués of contemporary New Age health food stores in India, ran away. Oh, he's not a good teacher. Look, he's eating. He's eating food. Huh? He's not eating sprouts. He's not eating, doesn't just live on vitamins. He has given up the path of spiritual anorexia. Let's take off, you know, let's leave him alone. And here he sat, poor Gautama, you know, and he was in the dark, you know. When he abandoned all the elements, the structures that he was functioning in up to that time, and sort of went into that dark, that his supreme enlightenment occurred. I mean, I'm just using that as an example, that I think even at that incredibly intense and high level, which certainly the enlightenment of the Buddha would have had to be, the alchemical principle is there. And so in the same way, Jung said, we have to allow periodically our own consciousness to undergo that kind of darkening. Now, the darkening doesn't mean that we have to become stupid or that we have to, darken our minds. But it is somewhat the same principle that St. John of the Cross, for instance, talks about in his famous great poem, which is referred to as the dark night of the soul. The dark night of the soul doesn't mean necessarily going into a great big deep depression and misery. Especially in medieval Spain, when there was no Prozac available, you know, that wouldn't have been all that great. But it means that the world as we knew it, the external world, or even the world of our ego, is allowed to darken. Now, the external world is darkens, for instance, whenever one goes into a meditation and excludes the data of the senses. But there is more to it than that. That is not, again, that is not so difficult. Most of us are willing to experiment with that. But to allow the ego world to darken, not to look at myself any longer as that persona and that ego that I have become accustomed to, that I am so-and-so. I derive my identity from all of these characteristics, from my schooling, at the present time probably from my political enthusiasms. You know, I am an ecologist, I am a feminist, I am a this, I am a that. You know what? You're none of those things. That's all flapdoodle. Which incidentally was the favorite word not only of Madame Blavatsky, but I recently learned of H.L. Mencken. Maybe that means that H.L. Mencken was a reincarnation of Madame Blavatsky, I don't know. But it's flapdoodle. So your concepts, the things that you are attached to, the things that are so important to you, they have to be allowed to sort of melt away. Your ego structure kind of melts away, and then the creative process really begins. And this creative process, as is implicit in the alchemical method, consists of what? Consists of two opposites, which begin to interact with each other. Now what does this mean? This means that psychic growth involves conflict. We transform by conflict. We don't transform by just peace. So, you know, the great worship of the peace of mind and all this sort of thing, it's up to a point that's all right, but it has its limitations. The human alchemist needs to be willing to endure conflict within himself. And to endure it consciously and to allow himself, herself to feel it. And out of that internal conflict then, eventually there emerges something new. But of course there is also something else. Don't you remember? There is a third element. There isn't just the king and the queen or salt and sulfur that interact upon each other, but there is Mercury. So Mercury has to be also there. And what is the Mercury in the human psyche? Well, it's the spiritual nature. It's like a triangle with its apex pointing upward, you know. Like the fire triangle, if you know the triangles of the elements. And the two corners of the triangle which are at the base are the opposites that interact with each other. But above them is the spirit of Mercury. So that as we are coping with the conflict, whatever that conflict happens to be, there can be all kinds of conflict between the masculine and the feminine. If we opt for one to the exclusion of the other, we have done the wrong thing. Why? Because as soon as we opt for one of the opposites and begin to exclude the other one, we have interrupted the process of alchemy. The alchemy has to be allowed to take place. You don't make it happen. Jung said, I don't make myself. I happen to myself. But this is very different from what a lot of people will tell you. lot of people, spiritual teachers, whatever they happen to be, say, discipline, discipline, discipline. You have to make yourself, you have to force yourself, you have to do this, you have to do that. Well, you know, a certain amount of discipline in everything is useful. We are much too undisciplined much of the time. But that kind of discipline can at best only be a preparation for something greater. Then comes the process. And you know what? And people don't like this, especially the new age, you know, doesn't like it. You are not in charge of the process. You are not in charge. You are not the boss. Oh, how terrible, how awful, how incredible, you know. You are not in charge. But there's something else that is in charge. And that is the spirit. The spirit of Mercury is in charge. When that is the facilitator, that is the agent of the transformation, the medium of the conjunction, as the alchemists call it. So what you have to have trust. Trust in the process. Trust in the wisdom of the ultimate center of the psyche. Trust in the process of transformation itself and its goals. And then it will happen. But you have to endure the conflict. We don't like to endure conflicts, especially in our day and age. We can see it in the incredible number of divorces and so forth. Now, I'm the last one to say that, you know, people make a mistake and get married, that they should stay married now forever. You know, that's nonsense. But on the other hand, just because there is conflict, two people rubbing against each other, that doesn't mean that one should run away. Because if one runs away, then surely nothing happens any longer, at least not with that person, does it? Well, it's the same way inside. So, you know, it's the art of not always taking sides, of not always associating ourselves with one priority to the exclusion of the other, but to look for something else. But this goes very contrary to the common tendency of our culture, because we develop certain mythologies in the culture. Sometimes they are this, sometimes they are that. I have been sort of a bemused observer and an almost participant, but only almost, in the American culture since the early 1950s, since I came here. You know, and that's why I said I never had to drop out in the 60s, because I never really dropped in. You know, so I've been always sort of watching to some extent. And there was a certain mythology, say, early, like in the 50s. There was a 50s mythology. Then there was a 60s mythology. Oh dear, was there ever a 60s mythology? And then there is one now. Each one of these mythologies is really unbalanced, because it always calls for you to associate yourself, to give your allegiance, to involve yourself. And this is commitment. You are committed to this, you are committed to that. Watch out. If you are so committed to a particular position, to a particular point of view, that you exclude, just really exclude the opposite, Then you stopped it, the whole process. Then there is no longer any growth. Then you are just a partisan of one kind or the other. And this also has to be true within yourself. So we have to be the alchemist who stands by the retort and keeps the slow, steady flame burning and watches the changes occurring in the retort, because something is really trying to happen. This is where the Chinese are right. And that is why Jung was also so much in favor of some of the Taoist principles at the philosophical and psychological level. Because, once again, it's not so much a matter of doing anything as it is more putting your ego self out of the way. When you put your ego self out of the way, then the real happening has a chance of happening. And if that is allowed to happen, and maybe repeatedly, when we endure the conflict, then after the conflict there is a reconciliation of the opposites. But that also doesn't occur right away. It occurs in its own good time. It occurs in alchemical time. finally the opposites are reconciled. And when you ever confronted with someone in whom that to some extent seems to have occurred, it's really quite a wonder to behold. I'm thinking of a particular person. I will give a talk about him sometime down the line. And I won't even mention the name. Was an older man already, or he lived into his 90s. When I first saw him, I said, this is a man in whom the opposites are either reconciled or are reconciling. You could tell by the very physical features and what was shining through them. This is somebody in whom the philosopher's stone is really beginning to work. People like that are not mugwumps. A mugwump is someone who, sort of a bird who sits on a fence with his mug on one side and his wump on the other side. You know? Fence-sitting creatures. You know, they are not equivocators. They are not lukewarm, namby-pamby people. They are quite capable of stating their position. But at the same time, there is a constant movement, a dance of the opposites and the reconciliation of the opposites going on in their nature. And then eventually it produces a wonderful thing, a real wholeness. That is the philosopher's stone, which now, after all that time, it has become an indivisible unity, a wholeness. That is what Jung called individuation. So the individuation process is an alchemical process. And its objective, its destiny is the individuum, which is the real name out of which, the Latin name out of which individual comes, which means an indivisible unity. So that we are all engaged in a process, the objective of which is the becoming of an indivisible unity. But the path toward that involves darkness, involves a black face and a white face and the yellow face and the red face, and the coming and the interactions of the opposites and the guidance of the spiritual nature. And then, ultimately, we are grown up. We have become what we were intended to become. And if that can be said even in to some extent, in some measure of us, before we walk off this earth in some fashion, when we no longer occupy this body, then our life has really served an authentic purpose. So it is somewhat along these lines that C.G. Jung rediscovered the meaning of alchemy internally within the individual, and thereby I think he has made a signal, an extremely important discovery, and has given us a tremendously important gift. C.G. Jung was also extremely interested in a particular great figure of the alchemical world, the great alchemist Paracelsus, who was his countryman, a Swiss, and about Paracelsus and his applications of these principles primarily to the medical field, we will speak on the next occasion. So I hope this has been of some interest to you and that we will see you next time. Thank you.
Copyright MMI by BC Recordings. Catalog number 300102. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.